Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I felt that I have to do my absolute best, like all the time. Otherwise, I'm sort of letting my child down somehow, because I need, you know, otherwise, if I'm not doing my best, I should be with him. And that became like a really huge, well, I guess a stressor as well, but a really huge push for me. And it made me really, you know, be like very serious, very committed to like really hardworking. It sort of like pushed those elements in me forward.
I'm delighted to share that this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast is sponsored by an artist, mother, and tax expert, Hannah Cole of Sunlight Tax. Is your creative practice gaining steam? Maybe you just got a big grant or a big show. You're excited to get to work, but a nagging feeling tells you that there are some tax issues that could hurt you. What you don't know might actually be holding you back from all that you can accomplish. You just want to get down to the studio and do the work you love, but finances and tax concerns are dragging you down. Thankfully, Sunlight Tax is here for you. Artist and tax pro Hannah Cole started Sunlight Tax to empower creative people with the tax and money tools you need so you can have more money, more time, and make a bigger impact with your work. Who doesn't want that? Sunlight Tax offers an annual membership called Money Bootcamp, which is tailored to your busy creative life to teach you targeted skills for your financial health and taxes. Hannah guides you through the pitfalls into simple systems so you can stay on track, start investing in yourself, and get back to the studio without getting bogged down. Right now, listeners of the Artist Mother Podcast can get a free artist tax deduction guide by going to sunlighttax.com/artistmother. That's sunlighttax.com/artistmother. Thank you, Hannah, for providing so much to artists and helping us through with all of our financial concerns. It's so reassuring to have experts like you we can trust and we know are looking out for us. Head to sunlighttax.com to find out more about everything Hannah has to offer, and don't forget your free artist tax deduction guide just for our community at sunlighttax.com/artistmother. Hello, friends. I am thrilled to welcome artist Anna Perach to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Anna is a Ukrainian-born Israeli artist living and working in London with her family, her partner, and her five-year-old son. She holds an MFA in fine art from Goldsmiths, University of London. She has exhibited internationally at galleries including White Cube Gallery in London, Live Works in Italy, Saatchi Gallery, and Larsen Warner Gallery in Stockholm, Sweden. In 2020, she was a finalist at the Birthrights Collection Biennial Competition for New Works and the Ingram Prize. Anna also received a grant for the production of new work from the Procreate Project via the Arts Council England. And some recent publications include Floor Magazine and the Calvert Journal. Anna, thank you so much for taking the time to be a part of the podcast. I'm excited to interview you and learn more about your work, and also thrilled that you are a Crit Group mentor for our Crit Group Crew program, which is launching in January as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited about the Crit Group and talking to you today.
Yes, I'm thrilled. I know we've had a couple conversations, but I feel like I already just feel a bond and a love for you already. So just so so thankful. Okay, so Anna, can you start by telling us, you know, a little bit about kind of what got you interested in art, maybe sharing something about your childhood that you feel like connects you to the artist that you are today?
I think that it was always sort of there. So as a child, it was just sort of if I wasn't sure what to do, I would just do some doodling or some drawing, and I would spend quite a lot of time doing that. Mm-hmm. Well, as a kid, I used to I used to draw with a lot of pens, the pens, sort of pens you write with, because pens could be markers in English as well. And I remember my mom trying to convince me to explore other materials. But I was quite relentless at trying to do different things with the pens. And I remember also my grandpa from my mother's side, when I was sort of like thinking what to do as a child, quite a young child, so like before 7, because it was back in Ukraine. And he was like, this is, I remember him pointing out that one of the sort of drawings I made and saying, this is your thing. This is what you should do, which he probably, meant nothing at this point, because, he was an engineer and, I don't think he was sort of inclined into, you should develop your art skills. That wasn't sort of the atmosphere. But, I don't know, it sort of stayed with me, I guess. Yeah, and also I think as a child, once my family moved to Israel from Ukraine and sort of had the freedom they didn't have back in the Soviet Union, we used to go every year to a major city in Europe. We do all the sort of art scenes. So we would go to all the museums and, all the sort of, we would see all the masters. So that was a big part of my education.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily enjoyed it at the time. I remember just being I want pizza.
Yeah.
I wasn't this is amazing. I wasn't a young art fan.
Right. Are there any kids who really are that into art, viewing art when they're little? I don't know.
I drag my kid to the museum quite often, since he was a tiny little baby. At the moment now, he's sort of I really try to make it fun for him.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly he and I try to talk him through it and sort of, try to find some things he can relate to in whatever show we're seeing. But he's not he's not totally game. Most of the time he would try to run off and find the exit.
Yeah.
Or play on the, one of those little sofas they put sometimes for people.
Yep.
To sit. So he would just lay on it and
snacks help,
Yeah.
I always promise my kids, first we're going to do this and then we're going to do that, but we're not going to do the second thing until we do the first thing.
I know, but that's tricky because you also wanted to, I don't want it. It's tricky because I don't want him to get the message that he needs to do it to please me.
Yeah.
Although he probably does, anyway, because, I think it's quite clear that that's sort of what mommy likes. I don't know. Actually, this Saturday we had a good surprising experience because we went to see a show at the Barbican, the whole family. And the whole family is my partner, me, and my son.
Mm-hmm.
And then we accidentally ran into some friends who just on the train, which never happens in London really. And they have a kid who's goes to the same school when she's slightly older.
Mm-hmm.
And they really bonded there. So they were sort of going on, he was happy because he had an older friend.
Yeah.
So they had their own sort of thing when they went around and we could just see the show. So maybe that's, that's sort of the trick. You just need to take some friends with you.
I think I have an 8-year-old and he definitely is at the age now more so where it's we can go in and we can have conversations about the work, but I still think there's a limit to how, if I'm trying to get through a museum in 2 hours versus 45 minutes, he's gonna lose his attention span, but but yeah, I also view vacations as mommy and daddy have stuff that we want to do too, and it's a collaborative experience. We're gonna do stuff for the kids and we're gonna do stuff for us and we're all gonna enjoy it,
I think there's a point there. Well, we're probably not all gonna enjoy it similarly, but it's also a decision you make as a parent.
Right.
I try to explain to him that it's good for your brain, it will make you think better.
Right.
So I feel like it's an educational decision I make for him as well.
Absolutely.
So, you know, like not all the parental decisions you make your kids are happy with, but you still sort of try to do your best.
Right. So Anna, yeah. You were born in the Ukraine and then you moved to Israel. How old were you when that happened?
So I was born in Ukraine back when it was the Soviet Union, which is sort of an important kind of information, because I think like from previous experience, when I said I'm like from Ukraine, I think people associated to, you know, the current day Ukraine.
Right.
And it's a bit of a different place in some ways than what it used to be when it was back, you know, one country or one, like the huge Soviet Union. So I sort of grew up in the Soviet Union and in Ukraine. When we moved to Israel, I was 7 years old.
Okay.
So yeah.
Do you remember, you know, the USSR?
Yeah, I do. I remember it quite well. I mean, obviously, I remember the things that have to do more sort of, you know, with, I don't know why, like I remember my nursery, mm-hmm. or some friends or some activities I used to do. We actually, like, went there to sort of visit the old life, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
My parents, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago now. I really loved it somehow. I remembered much more than I thought I would, mm-hmm. or my parents were really shocked. Like, I remembered how you go to some places, and it was quite amazing how much, you know, your memory holds to that information. It's just not being used or activated in any way, but it's definitely there.
Mm.
And yeah, I remember the whole sort of atmosphere as well. Like, mm-hmm. I watched that TV show Chernobyl like last year.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you've seen that, but I kind of felt like, well, that's, I don't know, probably the stereotype.
Yeah, I've seen it. I mean, I wasn't, like, our family wasn't affected by that directly. I think we lived, like, you know, quite far away, or it was 84 as well, right? Or I can't remember. I think it was like, I'm not sure I was alive yet.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I think it was like, I think, I can't, I'm not sure, but it was, anyway. But the atmosphere, you know, the Soviet sort of, the Sovietness of it all.
86.
86, yeah. So I was 1 year old. I was 90. But the atmosphere, I think, was really sort of precise. How they, besides even the, you know, the narrative and how horrible and yeah, I mean, it's a very kind of complex program. But I mean, just in terms of the, you know, the Soviet experience, I think they showed it in a very,
yeah, the culture
really close to how I remember it. Like, there was something so precise about how, you know, everything, I don't know, there is something claustrophobic, but mm-hmm. also sort of
utilitarian. Like,
yeah, but there is like something also sort of somehow so idealistic about mm-hmm. how it looks. And I was really destroyed by that after seeing it. I was like really affected for some time. They're just like, I felt like something really deep within me was touched by seeing that. And obviously, you know, it's quite a difficult event from other aspects as well. But
yeah. And then you moved to Israel and you were there till how long? Is your family still in Israel, or are they in London with you?
No, my parents still live there. I mean, the reason we moved to Israel was, I mean, the whole, like, you know, when the Soviet Union fell apart in the early 90s, everybody who could move would move. So a lot of people migrated either to Israel, the States, or Germany. And I remember kind of conversations between my parents where my mom would be like, oh, we should move. We should go there and here. And my dad were, you know, more sort of, you know, he felt like more conservative, I guess. Like, what would we do there? Like, what sort of security would we have there, and so on? And then he received an offer like a work offer in Israel, and that sort of determined everything.
What does he do?
He's God, I memorized that once. basically, he's like a really high sort of high class, whatever, engineer deals with magnesium.
Okay.
And as far as I know from him, because as you can hear, this is as far of my sort of, you know, knowledge than I have no idea, basically. But he's like he has like a particular expertise,
yeah,
and five of like the most sort of experts in that field in the world. So yeah, so when in Israel in the Dead Sea they were building sort of a factory that was specifically in his area of expertise, they invited him, and yeah, that's how we moved. We are also Jews, which was kind of, you know, which helped, I guess.
Yeah.
But we're not practicing at all, you know, coming from a Soviet heritage. But yeah, I'm sure that they made things that fit in with everything. So yeah, so I grew up there. And then when I was 29, I think it was, we moved to the UK for my partner's PhD, and then, you know, things happen, and so far we're here.
Yeah. So your partner's from Israel as well?
Yeah, my partner is from Israel as well. Yeah, born and raised, sort of thing.
That's great. I've traveled a little bit in my life, and I do just kind of feel that it's just so important to like understanding different perspectives and worldviews. But just, I'm always fascinated by people who've lived in different countries and sort of have that, I don't know, like just monumental experience as a child, like sort of switching cultures. It's just really fascinating.
I think it's quite a traumatic thing. Yeah. And I think, something like traumatic, not only in a, you know, in a sort of, trauma usually is kind of a word that associates with something difficult, or which it is, but I think it's a traumatic event in the sense that it really changes you and your identity for, you know, you become some, it's a different sort of life experience, I think.
Yeah, I would think so too.
But in difficult ways, but in brilliant ways as well. So, yeah.
Hmm. All right, Anna. So let's talk about your art. I want you to describe it for somebody who has never seen it before, who might be listening. Maybe this is the first time, you know, that after they hear the episode, they'll go and look up your work. But if they haven't ever seen it, could you talk a little bit about it, what materials you use, and a little bit about your process?
Sure. I think, how should I go about it? So what I do basically is I create carpets with a technique called tufting, which is quite an old technique. So I create carpets manually, and then I make them I sew them into 3D sculptures, which are also wearable sculptures. And then I create performances with them, where I have performers who are wearing basically the wearable sculptures and perform. So my process is kind of divided into different parts. I start off by, you know, having a sketch of what sort of thing. I do research constantly. That's just sort of, you know, part of what I do. I read, I think, it's like I have a dialogue in my mind constantly. And then when it comes to a point where I have to, you know, really create something for a specific show or, a show, let's say, I create sketches. I make patterns for what I want to do, as you would do with, if you would like to make a garment. I don't know the patterns myself. I work with somebody who can assist me doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I place each piece of the pattern on my frame. I tuft it. I draw a pattern inside, which is what I want to create. I tuft it. When everything is finished, I have all the pieces, I sew them by hand because they don't really go into a machine. And then I will do probably a lining inside, or I'll pad some places just to kind of hold the form a bit more. And then I will begin with the the works are shown either as sculptures or as part of performances or both.
Right.
So I would work with a carpenter to create a wooden structure that would go inside the sculpture. And if there is a performance planned as well, I would work with my with the movement director I've been collaborating with in the past 2.5-3 years. His name is Luigi Ambrosio, and he's wonderful.
Mm.
Well, we would work together on, you know, the sort of the set of movements and what the performance wants to achieve and so on. And then if it's a performance, I would work with a sound producer as well to create specific sort of atmosphere and sound for the space. So if it's sculpture, it tends to be more sort of a private process, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Once it becomes performance, it's a much more collaborative work. I still feel that, you know, most of the decisions come from my sort of direction, but I'm open to, you know, to hear the influence and the ideas that the people I work with have. That's sort of the practical side of things, I guess.
So involved. Like, it seems like such a collaborative process, and there's just so many moving parts, which is really interesting. Could you talk a little bit about how you arrived here? Like, I can't imagine when you were starting out in the arts, you thought that this would be the work that you're making, you know? I'm curious to hear kind of the trajectory of your art career. Like, were you doing sculpture and textile work from the beginning, or were you, you know, do you have more of a like foundational background in painting and drawing? Could you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, as a child, I used to do painting and drawing. And, you know, until sort of my BA, basically, that's what I did. And a lot of other artists I know, that's sort of how they started. I think in some ways that's the most, you know, intuitive, basic thing you do. I mean, some people start with sculpture immediately, but a lot of people, you know, doodling and drawing was the most basic thing for me. And then when I did my BA, I was quite young. I did it when I was 19. I sort of began exploring sculpture, and I was really attracted to sort of more 3D and installation-based work. And I did some work with textile and printing. And I think I was, I mean, I will speak about it now from sort of the place where I am now. So it's all kind of perspectively, you can see how those things were in your very early practice. I don't think I had a clear idea of what I was doing back then.
Right.
But I think sort of ideas about domesticity and the domestic space and how you can work with different elements within it, textile was something that I was sort of exploring already back then, but really sort of, you know, in very early touches sort of thing. And then I completely did something else. So I when I finished my BA in art, I was 23, and then I took some time to just sort of, figure out who I am a bit more.
Yeah.
And I did, after that, I started working in with mental health, and I ended up doing a diploma in art therapy and counseling. And I always had a sort of studio practice, but it sort of became more like, you know, I wasn't really pushing to show it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working as a counselor and art therapist with children for a while. And then when we relocated to the UK, in that time when I had that sort of quiet studio practice, I explored, again, I think painting. I wanted to be, you know, really sort of, I wanted to do everything myself. I didn't want to have involvement from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest way for me was to do it with painting because I felt, you know, I'm self-sufficient in that sense. But I did explore a bit of sculpture towards the end and installation. And then when we moved to the UK, I felt that everything, you know, the deck was reshuffled, you say. We say in Hebrew, I don't know if that translates well into English. But basically everything sort of, you know, changed. I had no anchors. I had nothing of what I was sort of felt supported by. So the only thing I was left with was I felt like art would be, you know, that was my anchor. That's something I could have done. And so I really, and then I was, and then we got pregnant. So there was a major sort of identity crisis again. So I think,
how long have you been making the work that you make right now?
Oh yeah, I went too far, haven't I? I was like, I'll go 15 years back. So I think I started doing tufting in the last 3-4 years. So when I was kind of going, you know, jumping a bit forward, before doing my MA, which I did part-time for 4 years, I started doing a lot of embroidery work, and I was thinking about how, you know, how you can kind of inflict the domestic environment with sort of more, like, you know, the more sort of, I don't know, anyway, explore it. Let's say, put it like that. And when I came to Goldsmith and I found out about tufting, about this technique, I was immediately drawn to it. I started doing initially two-dimensional masks, and then those masks grew into three-dimensional masks, and then the three-dimensional masks grew into a full sort of wearable sculpture.
It's just crazy to me that you kind of had this journey of, I don't know, like, I mean, in a way, every art journey is a slow drip, right? Because we can kind of always pull the threads of like, well, this is related to what I'm doing now and this is and this is. But it sounds like you kind of, you know, you went through art school, your undergrad, and then you had this like break where you weren't really sure what, you know, you wanted to make and what you were going to do. And then now it kind of feels like it just came to you and it's like this big, you know, like it just feels like this world cracked open and now like, you know what you're supposed to be making and you're just doing it. And I don't know, I just find that really interesting because I think so often I think of, well, a couple things. I think artists feel like we can't take a break from our work. If we don't feel like we're really making the work that we should be making, it's really hard to just set it aside maybe and focus somewhere else for a while and trust that, you know, maybe we need to have some life experience that's going to change that trajectory or like, I don't know. I feel like that feels so scary to me to like just kind of move the focus off for a while and trust that it'll come back or it'll be there later, you know?
I think those are just things that sort of happen. I don't think I had this sort of, you know, a trust that it will come back. I honestly thought, you know, I got accepted to Tavistock just before I did my MFA, which is sort of a diploma in like going really deep into psychotherapy and becoming like a psychotherapist. And you know, I felt that I could use sort of the imagery language I had in my mind for that as well. And I still do in some ways. So, but you know what, like when you were speaking, I was thinking about something as well. I had a friend, a good friend, like during my BA, and she started working with the film director at a certain point. And he was quite an elderly person. And I remember she told me like about his life journey and how, you know, he did this. He had like a really big success with that film. And then for 10 years, he lived in the desert riding horses or something. And, you know, like, and then he was a doctor for a while. And then he was, you know, I just felt like that's so inspiring, mm-hmm. you know, that generally I feel that it's like so interesting to think how people have complete, well, probably it looks completely different from external point of view, but how people like have different lives in their life.
Yeah, I agree.
And I love that. Like even my parents, you know, like hearing them out, they had their life in the Soviet Union and that's all they knew. And that was, you know, it wasn't a place that was open. So I don't know how much they really knew about the West.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had a completely different lifestyle from 40 years old till now. So I find that it's really hopeful that mm-hmm. you're like, I really like the promise that it can bring.
I think too, just thinking of like the art world right now and how we feel so much pressure to just to achieve everything all at once, you know, and to kind of like find your voice and lean into like what you're supposed to do and push really hard into that. And it, you know, it can make a lot of people really crack like under that pressure. It's hard. So I think it's nice to think about, you know, and I feel like we talk about this a lot on this podcast, just because it relates to the maternal journey of like not having a lot of time and, you know, how your art career really is a long, long game, you know, but it's hard to really remember that in the moment. But then you kind of can look back and see, you know, how your sort of wanderings and your different journeys really do make up this complete piece that feels like interconnected to like the work that you're making right now.
I think the pressure also comes in more when you do have a more sort of established practice, mm-hmm. you know, like I relate to what you're saying about this pressure to create and have this, you know, and be as committed as you can be and produce and do and show. I can feel it. I can relate to it more so now from you know, having a bit more of a, like having a practice really.
Mm-hmm.
But I think until you, like it took me a while to get to this place where I feel like I have something to lose in a way. Mm-hmm. I think like beforehand, I was just like thinking, oh, is this my journey? Is it really my thing? Or is it just like a beginning to something else?
Right.
I think there was less professional pressure back then.
Right.
In a way.
Do you feel like part of that pressure though is, you know, helpful, that it does like cause you to produce monumental work?
So I went to do my MFA when my kid was 9 months old, when he was quite a baby. So once I became a mom, so it's interesting because it's like for me, you know, it was like really, it sort of came together. So when I was pregnant, I was sort of like, okay, I don't know. I remember like I was completely bored being pregnant. I was doing and going crazy. And I used to go swimming a lot because that's what you like need to do when you, I don't know, they recommend it.
I did too. I'm not a swimmer, but I did swim when I was pregnant.
I mean, I love being bothered, to be honest, but I was really committed because I didn't have much of other things going at that time.
Yeah.
So I remember like swimming in this pool constantly in circles, like a fish or something. And like thinking, I should really do this art thing. Like it's either now or never. Like I felt this rush suddenly because I knew I was, you know, going to be a mom and it's a life change and everything. So I dragged my husband with me to to the Slade and to Goldsmiths, to all the open days, because I was so intimidated by everything, being outside of the art world for a lot of years, just like, come with me, like, I need to see. And I was going there, I was even more intimidated because everybody seemed kind of young and cool, and I was like 9 months pregnant.
Yeah.
Like a rolling ball there, like trying to go on the stair. And like, so.
But I was pregnant in school too, so.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
so you know how it feels.
Yep, I do. If you feel, you definitely feel odd.
Yeah, you feel very like, you know, it's also like the last time before that I was in art school, I was like 23, and I was like myself pretty young and like, you don't know, going for drinks. So I don't know, whatever is associated with being young. So coming back there in sort of completely different situation, I think I was like shocking myself in a way.
Yeah.
But anyway, I didn't really believe I would be accepted to any of those. But when I did and I decided to do it, I was, I felt, you know, with all the sort of guilt and the complexity of being a parent. And I felt that I sort of, I have to do my absolute best, like all the time. Otherwise I'm sort of letting my child down somehow. Because I need, you know, otherwise if I'm not doing my best, I should be with him.
Yeah.
That sort of, and that became like a really huge, well, I guess a stressor as well, but a really huge push for me.
Mm.
And it made me really, you know, be like very serious, very committed to like really hardworking. It sort of like pushed those elements in me forward.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to sort of that pressure being two-sided, like, you know, that the time constraint and sort of the value that you're putting into this while you also have this other amazing thing that, you know, you prioritize, like it does really push you, but then it's also like, I don't know, you feel like your time is so precious that, you know, everything you make has to be perfect in a way.
I think that relates to what we were speaking about, production, like mm-hmm. having to make work. And you, like, what I kind of fantasize about is having that time where, like, I don't know, you always see in pictures, like artists just sitting in their studio.
Right.
Reading a book, doing a sketch, and then like, oh, this is, you know, I feel more like, okay, I have to make like decisions, and
yeah.
I have to, and my, you know, my process of work is quite, you know, there's a lot of labor, physical labor that goes into it.
Yeah.
I have to work really. And yeah. So.
And other than like research, can you do any work at home, or is it mostly because those structures are so big and you're doing the tufting? Does that have to kind of all happen in dedicated studio time?
Yeah, mostly. I mean, there are like the little wall-based kind of tuftings I make. I sometimes sew them at home, or sometimes I would take, you know, the lining or something, or I would take some elements of the work from the studio and I would finish it at home. But I try as much as I can to separate those things because, you know, I answer, well, to be honest, I do a lot of, you know, I answer emails at all times.
Yeah. Yep.
So there is that side of the work as well, which is just an ongoing constant thing. Like I, all, you know, and I try to answer people as quick as I can. So just because I'm afraid of, otherwise I'll like forget or something.
Right.
Yeah, I think sometimes I feel that that side of the work is taking quite a lot of time as well, and that is definitely something I do at home. But ideally, I also work 2 days a week, so I have like 3 days for my studio, 2 days for work, and then. Yeah, and, you know, the weekends where I try to spend as much time as I can with my family.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there's always this sort of there, you know, like, oh, maybe if I'll go, but like maybe if I go to the studio, I would finish more work. But on the other hand, I feel that if I didn't have a child, I would probably never rest. Just be locked in the studio. So some of it is also like, I'm thinking, oh, this, you know, this is actually good for my well-being just as a human. Like we're to do stuff, we're just sitting and you know, like I guess all the things that people do in their social time, I just do with my 5-year-old.
Yeah.
I go to little like dates with him, you know, and stuff.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. Like going, you know, getting a hot chocolate and sitting down at a cafe or, like reading, sitting down and reading a book out loud to a child is, I mean, it really does slow you down. It's very pleasurable.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. It's a constant sort of battle, but I prefer that battle than other battles that I have. So
yes, for sure. I'm proud to share that this episode of the Artist Mother podcast is sponsored by Faherty. Faherty is a family-run clothing brand fueled by purpose and optimism. They make high-quality, sustainably-minded, feel-good fragrance that you'll be proud to wear. This clothing that's made not just to last the season, but a lifetime of wear. For the past few years, I've recently tried to curb my clothes shopping habits and change what I wear to reflect my values. I've pared down my clothes to things I feel good in and feel good about, which means buying less fast fashion and making fewer purchases overall, but buying more high quality pieces when I do buy my clothes. Faherty brand fits right into this model, and I'm kind of obsessed with their Arlie Day pants. They are super comfortable, but help me look slightly more put together than my usual yoga pants outfits. Anybody feel me? Faherty brand believes in social justice and has partnered with and supported some organizations you may recognize, like United Natives, Artists for Peace and Justice, the Trevor Project, and the Audre Lorde Project. They're also holding their company to a high standard with sustainability, designing clothes to last that are made with low impact on the environment. You can shop Faherty by heading to fahertybrand.com/artistmother. Use code ARTISTMOTHER, all lowercase, all together, for 25% off your purchase. It really means a lot when you support the brands that help support our podcast. Check out Faherty's website today and use code ARTISTMOTHER for a 25% off discount. That's pretty generous, guys. Thank you so much, Faherty, for supporting this podcast and our community. And now, back to our episode. So when you say you're still working 2 days a week, is that doing art therapy and counseling?
Yeah, so I run, I work for a charity called Place to Be, which is a charity that supplies provides mental health services to schools around the UK. And I work for a primary school and I run the service for them. So I don't do counseling directly, but I sort of supervise the counselors. I make sure that, you know, that we get the right sort of children referred to the service and that we can actually support them. I support some of the families. That's something I do 2 days a week.
How is that sort of going to school and getting into counseling and art therapy? How has that like influenced your art practice?
I mean, in some ways, you know, I'm really interested in stories and storytelling, and I think, and I'm also really interested in how, you know, how we sort of like the exploration of like really deep and primal sort of inhibitions and desires and you know, like what sort of drives us as humans and how different experiences transform us. And quite often I work with women as well, and because you usually work with mothers. So, you know, those are all things that I also explore in my own practice, I think for me, you know, what I strive to create with my practice, with my art practice, is to have a space where people can experience and feel. And I think within kind of my more counseling work, what I enjoy about the work is being in this, in a space, ideally, because nowadays, you know, some things are being made in Zoom depending on
right
where we stand with lockdowns. But ideally, what I enjoy is some sort of similar to like having a performance. It's the immediate contact with the person is really lending myself to their experience and let it kind of go through me and processing it with them and for them as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see how it's connected and how the elements of story and performance and, you know, care and processing feelings, like I can see how all of that is sort of interwoven.
As a counselor, you're sort of a vessel and I think in some ways, you know, thinking about it from that point of view, I think the wearable sculptures are sort of a vessel as well. You can take in, take off, take out. Yeah, I don't know, but
Anna, when you gave birth, like, did that really influence your art practice at all, or your ideas of creation, or even your ideas of yourself? You just kind of talked about this, like the primal desires of humans, and it just made me think about, you know, this primal experience of birth, and I was wondering a little bit about your story.
I don't know how processed my birth experience is, to be honest with you. I think it was a complete shock, and it didn't went according to plan at all. And the whole pregnancy I had a good pregnancy physically, like everything, and a good birth, like went okay. It was super long, but other than that, but I think for me, you know, it really, I think I kind of tend to be in my head a lot.
Yeah.
And I felt quite disconnected from my body for most of my life in different ways. And I think the experience of being pregnant and having a child and giving birth, it sort of pushed me into having this contact with my body, it was quite a difficult experience for me as well. Like, you know, your body's constantly changing in a very dramatic way.
Yeah.
You have no control, no choice over it. You know, there is a sense of enormous care for your body, but also this feeling of invasion that your body is sort of been, you know, it's taken away from you. So, you know, I have no choice other than to sort of like, I had to kind of be focusing on my body, and you do all those tests and everything to make sure, you know, everything's going according to plan and you're well and the baby is well. I don't know. And then, you know, also the experience of having to take care of somebody's little fragile body, and they're so like mushy and tiny in the beginning. I was completely freaked out, you know, like, what is this? I wasn't like, I don't know. I mean, it was super difficult for me. I'm very lucky to have a partner that was, you know, he's super cool about everything. So he was like really responsible for a lot of like the physical care in the beginning, especially. And I was kind of like just shocked.
Yes. and still processing. I love that idea of I'm still processing, and your kid is five. You know, I'm probably still processing, and my oldest is eight. You know.
I think it's definitely, it's just like such a powerful experience in terms of how you are vulnerable and how life is vulnerable. And there is so much different feelings. Like I felt really connected to my partner suddenly. And I was like, oh, how do even people kind of separate after having this experience together? You know, this is like life and death. Mm-hmm. But then, like, you know, 5 years later, I'm like,
Again, sometimes it's that thing that can make it really good or make it really bad.
Yeah, exactly. But that's, I felt like it really pushed me. Like I had it was so powerful. I had nowhere to run, which was incredibly difficult. Like it wasn't like romantic in any way or shape. Mm. So, yeah. But I do like my kid, I have to admit. He's like not just like, I think that helped as well. He was always like quite, I don't know, I like him as a little person.
Yeah.
You know, not just like, I love him, obviously, because he's my, like, I have a care for him and I love him and everything. Right. And he was always like, I don't know, I like him.
Yeah, I like that. Tell me a little bit about childcare and how that has played into your practice. I know now you're at, you know, kind of the, he's of school age, but those first 5 years, were you still working as a counselor? In the art therapy program, were you, like, how were you kind of balancing making work and another job and having, you know, a small child now to occupy your time?
I mean, it all happens sort of gradually. You have to remember that we came to the UK 7 years ago. So everything sort of, you know, we kind of, like, now I'm at the point where my life is sort of like, I have a house, I have a job, I have a studio practice, I have a kid, like I'm now at this point where I'm sort of like a fully formed adult.
Right.
This is not the case, like, not that much long ago. So when we had a kid, 9 months after that, he went to a childminder. I went for 3 days a week. I went to do my art degree, my MA. My husband was doing his PhD, so he was sort of more flexible than somebody who may be going to the office 8 to 5, because we're partly working from home, and sort of divided it between us and the childminder. Mm. And then when he was two, he went to a nursery, and that was 5 days a week.
So that's a unicorn.
Oh, thank you, Shaya. This is lovely. Okay, I'll see you in a bit. So yeah, so in the beginning he used to go 3 days a week, and then we would split it somehow between us. And then, you know, sort of the more he grew and he quite enjoyed nursery, we enjoyed doing other things as well. While he's nursery. I mean, I think most of all, to be honest, what kind of enabled me, so we don't have any family support here.
Right.
There's no grandmas and grandparents taking him after. And we, you know, we didn't want to have more, you know, additional care for him besides nursery, like, or for financial reasons, but also just because it felt, you know, like you want to spend some time with him and he needs that and you need it. So we basically split it between us, my partner and I. And yeah, he's more flexible than a lot of dads that I know. And that kind of really enabled me to do a lot.
Yeah. I have the same kind of partner. So, Does your son ever go to the studio with you? Or not, I mean, so much?
No. Like, recently we started to do it a bit more. But, you know, before that he was too small. And I have, like, a lot of like needles and mm-hmm. pointy, scary things there.
Yeah.
He would go, you know, if I need to do like things that I need my husband to help me with, like lifting stuff or, you know, building things, whatever, then he would, and you know, it's, there is no one else, like there is no nursery or anything, then he right. would come with us, and then, you know, he would spend some time there. And just recently we started taking him like on a weekend, like all three of us will go to the studio. It has a nice sort of, it's in a nice area, and we can have a walk and just go together to the studio. But I don't know. It's always like a question. Should you do it together? Should you really separate? Am I going there, you know, to actually do my work?
Right.
Or am I going there and I'm like, we're spending family time? I don't know. It's always a question for me, how much it is for me.
Yeah, and like, where's your headspace? And
yeah, mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know if it's good or not.
Yeah.
I haven't decided. It's probably bad.
Anna, let's talk a little bit more about sort of this storytelling element to your work and how it's really influenced by folklore, right?
Yeah.
I kind of want to hear, you know, you just share a little bit more about that. Like, what kind of research are you doing? What, you know, where is this folklore coming from that you are, you know, where you're kind of drawing inspiration? And then we'll wrap up the interview.
I think sort of the main three kind of pillars of my practice have to do with folklore and storytelling. And then there is the craft element, and there is the element of femininity. And I think they're all sort of tied together. Like they share a common history in some way. They were all kind of marginalized. And used in different ways. There is a correlation there. In terms of the specific stories or, you know, folklore, so I started off with exploring Slavic folklore, which is my heritage and the things I grew up with. And I felt really comfortable there just because I felt familiar with the imagery. But also, you know, I didn't want to, you know, kind of offend anyone's culture or to touch on anyone's heritage, which I wasn't really, you know, knew the meaning of.
Right.
But the more I kind of looked deep into the different characters I was looking into, I found that, you know, there are similarities among all cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm working with, you know, the idea of archetypes, and according to people like Jung, those things kind of repeat in all cultures. So you would have, you know, the virgin, the big mother character, this big kind of archetypical characters, the shadow, and so on. So I kind of work with those elements nowadays and rework them. All my characters, I think about them as women or as female.
Mm-hmm.
Have to be, you know, there is, I think they're female in the sense that they're related to, they're associated with femininity and the things we as a Western culture associate with femininity as well. But they don't have to be biologically female. I mean, I'm open to people who, you know, like if somebody who has a more fluid sense of gender identity feel kind of closer to that, I'm happy with that. You know, there is no restriction in that sense. So I think it's femininity more as a kind of concept or cultural concept than a biological gender.
Hmm. Like, tell me how the process of researching and hearing about and becoming inspired by a specific tale or story, and then how does performance and sort of building these narratives sort of break down for you? Are you kind of reimagining the stories? Are you just reenacting the stories? Like, can you talk a little bit about the way performance comes into sort of the characterization and what your characters do?
I think I'm trying to think about who those characters are. And, you know, in terms of not, because a lot of the, you know, folk tales, they're sort of, we tend to think about them as something, you know, like way back in history, and I imagine it as like, you know, the historical outfits, whatever. Mm-hmm. But for me, I'm more interested in the essence of those characters. Mm-hmm. For example, a character, you know, like Baba Yaga, which is a character of a witch from Slavic folktale, and she's this character who lives in the outskirts of society, and she kind of she doesn't conform to any of the norms expected of women, I guess. Right. And she's also a witch, so she has this magical abilities, which is something, you know, that throughout history men was, you know, patriarchal society was sort of concerned about this essence of having something that's not controlled, that's is not understood cognitively,
right?
Yes,
mystery.
She's carrying that sort of essence. So for me, I feel those ideas are still existent in our culture, and you know, they're everywhere. Like, look at Trump,
right?
So I think for me, it's interesting to bring that character and play around with it. And then the fact that it's made out of carpet, which immediately associates with, you know, the domestic environment, it give you a feeling that it's in your home. It's mm-hmm. everywhere. It's not this like ancient concept.
Right. Yeah, it's another layer of sort of connection between the stories and you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think when I do the performances, it depends which performance, but no, I'm not trying to reenact the original stories,
mm-hmm.
or to take, you know, whatever essence that character holds for me, and create a relationship with different characters. It really depends on the performance, but I think the idea of transformation and kind of moving from, you know, like
shape-shifting.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
that's something I'm really interested in. You know, it's kind of
what
we spoke about in the beginning of the conversation, is how you can live different lives in your life and how your identity changes through all of them.
How, you know, your identity as an artist and mother can take different forms even throughout the day, like kind of just talking about, you know, where is my focus right now? Who am I? What hat am I wearing?
It's quite amazing though, no? Like how I remember when my child was really young, I felt this, and going to art school again, I felt like really like super disconnected. Like I have all this, like a broken glass. I have all this and I have no idea how it all comes together. And then now I feel that, you know, I feel that they're less broken. It's one glass, but I'm sort of sometimes find it disturbing how quickly now I can move between different parts of myself.
Mm.
And I'm like, how does that happen? Like, what?
I love like, that. I feel, and I love that your work kind of speaks to that notion too.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, the whole sort of sewing all the bits together in a way.
Yeah. Just to close, I want to have you talk a little bit about the project Seven Wives. I know that's a more recent piece. Could you share just a little bit more about that conceptually and the production of it?
So that piece was kind of inspired by the story of Bluebeard, which is a folktale about this person, a man who marries women and then they die in mysterious circumstances. And there are different versions of that story, but the one I sort of took as an inspiration is told from a point of view of his recent wife. Mm. And, you know, she quite often, she comes from this lower socioeconomical class, and he's this rich man, slightly deformed, right? He has this blue beard, which makes him slightly sinister and reveals perhaps something of what is going to happen. But and then he marries her and he brings her to his huge mansion. And then he says, oh, on their wedding night, I have to leave for business. And he leaves her a bunch of keys and he tells her, you can go to any room besides this room, which he obviously goes to, where she finds the six heads of his previous wives and their bodies. And then obviously he comes back. It was all part of his sort of,
plan. Test.
Exactly. And there are different versions. In some of them, she's, he kills her as well. In some of them, she's being saved by her brothers or her mother or whoever is the storyteller, which is something I love about folklore as well. You know, how you can kind of play around with the stories. Mm-hmm. And it's okay, like that's what they're for. Anyway, so it was kind of, there is a really famous illustration that was done for that story, where you see kind of the seven heads hanging from their hair. Mm-hmm. I saw a Pina Bausch piece she did with that story, and I loved it. And then when I went to research about it, I found this illustration, and it just sort of worked with other ideas I had in mind, because I was thinking a lot about like hysteria and female hysteria and depression and all sorts of things. And when I saw that image and thinking more and more about that piece, I really thought about, going back to the beginning of what I told you, about my experience with kind of this head-body division of how, how our heads are sort of associated with this. I thought, basically I thought it's really interesting how the body was cut off and what is left is the head, and the head associated with the mind, which is the more, control, conscious, rational part of it. And what was cut off is the body, which is, the part that is uncontrollable, vague, in some ways transformative, can carry life. And kill wildlife. So, so I made seven heads, seven tufted heads, and they were hung on S-hooks, which is like how you hang meat, on a rope. And then I had three performers entering, that entered three of the masks, and they moved in ways that resemble, that was inspired by sort of movements that were quite common with women who experience hysteria, when hysteria was diagnosed by Freud in the early, what was it, 20th century, late 19th, early 20s.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Sure, thanks.
It's a beautiful piece. Okay, Anna, five questions to close, just for us to get to know you a little bit better, okay?
Cool. Okay, let's do it.
All right, who's your biggest art crush?
So I was thinking about that. I hate to choose, but I think what's her name? Something Carrington. I always get like blackouts when people ask me this question.
I think a lot of people do.
I'm like, who's your favorite? I'm like, I don't know anyone.
Dora Carrington?
I think Leonora Carrington.
Oh, Leonora Carrington, yeah.
A huge crush of mine. Alina Sapochnikov, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is a huge crush of mine. Ellie Sneal, Leonora Finney. So a lot of women.
Okay, what is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
I love the desert. That's, I mean, where I grew up in Israel, it's a very southern city, and it's quite close to the desert. So maybe that's part of it. But I love dryness. I love the yellow color. I love sand. I love how, you know, it sort of burns your mind out of thoughts. Mm-hmm. Like I can see, and I love that. Overthinker, and I enjoy that very much. So the desert, definitely.
Have you been, have you experienced multiple different kinds of deserts? Have you been to the U.S. desert, for example?
No, I wish, I really hope I would one day. The desert I know is the Israeli desert. Mm. So that's sort of my reference to it. But yeah, I mean, I really hope I would have that experience.
Yeah. What film or book has inspired you greatly?
I really like I read it when I was 14, but it's called Master and Margarita, mm-hmm. or The Devil in Moscow. I think there has different translations. It's by Bulgakov. And it's a really good book. It's about, I really like the combination of sort of fantasy and realism in it. Mm. I love that book.
What is your favorite meal?
I love rice. Mm. Like, it's not cool. But, you know, when I watch Survivor and lots of crap TV. And, you know, on Survivor, they always complain I hate rice. I would do really good on that. I can just eat rice all day long and I'll be happy.
Do you cook it a specific way or just plain stovetop cooked fluffy rice?
Whatever. Yeah. Like rice with vegetables, rice with mushrooms, rice, all sorts of rice. I love rice. Mm.
I like rice too, but I usually like to do something with it, you know, add some saffron or cook it with vegetables or something, like you said.
Yeah, no, obviously that's a bit better, but yeah. I'll be happy with just white rice as well.
White rice. Yeah, I love that.
White rice, yeah.
All right, Anna. And then to close, I always like to offer a space for you to give a shout out or a thank you for someone who supports your art practice.
I think I would like to give a big thank you to Procreate Project, which is an organization that supports women artists.
Diana Gravina, another artist, Mother Crit Group mentor.
And they also, as you mentioned in the beginning, they commissioned the Seven Wives Project. Mm. And I took part in the Mother Art Prize a few years ago. And they're generally, I think they're doing something really amazing. A lot of people, I hope as many people would know about them as possible.
Yeah, I agree. They are doing a lot of good for the artist mother community and specifically in, the UK area.
Yeah.
Okay. And where can people find out more about you and your work? What's your Instagram and website?
Just my name, both.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We will get this interview up and I know everyone's going to love it. Thanks for sharing, more about your work and just talking us through what it's like to be inside your head a little bit, be in your artist mother world. So thank you so much, Anna.
No, thank you. Thank you for your time. I really enjoyed that.
The Artist Mother Podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.